areas of historical investigation within the profession today is what we might call local history. And our third panelist's remarks, which he entitles Town and Tradition in the Old Republic, at least partly is based upon some of his own researches into the local history of Western New York and in the nature of law and the legal system at the local level in the early Republic. Our third speaker is Professor John Wilson of Hillsdale College, who is engaged in the process of writing and publishing in both these areas, the law and the town in early America. He's going to begin, as I understand, with some remarks on John Adams, who's another third something from this period, and move on from there into a more wide discussion of the meaning of provincial life at the time of the founding of the American experience. John.
Thank you, Bill. Professors Bradford and McDonald have talked about illustrious gentlemen indeed. I'm going to talk about just plain old country folks. And what I have to say is, in sentiment, and intent at least, pretty much what James Jackson Kilpatrick said last night, if you remove the statue of the Confederate soldier. I can't say it so poetically, so I've got it all wrapped up in quotations and implied footnotes. This is about the northern country towns. In the years of the Revolution, and perhaps one generation longer, at least until the age of egalitarianism appears with the evil Andrew Jackson after 1830. One of the better known statements of John Adams is in his essay on the meaning of the American Revolution, written and published when he was 83. The Revolution, he says, was effected before the war commenced. The Revolution was in the hearts and minds of the people. What is not as well known is that Adams linked these hearts and minds to New England in a very precise way. In a letter to the Abbé de Mably in 1782, in the course of discussing sources for Mably's proposed general history of the American conflict, Adams interrupts his discourse on sources to give what he calls a key to all this history: towns, schools, congregations, militia. He finds them what he calls a decisive effect in the pre-war writings, in the debates, in the resistance, in arms, and he regards them as the proper examples to all the other colonies. And then he says even more directly, "Behold, sir, a little sketch of the four principal sources of that prudence and counsel and that military valor and ability which have produced the American Revolution, and which I hope will be sacredly preserved as the foundations of the liberty, happiness, and prosperity of the people." 4 years later, he elaborated on this in a rather telling way. This is an entry in his diary for the 21st of July, 1786. Major Langhorne dined with us again. He was lamenting the difference of character between Virginia and New England. I offered to give him a recipe for making a New England in Virginia. He desired it, and I recommended to him town meetings, training days, town schools, and ministers, giving him a short explanation of each article. The meeting house and schoolhouse and training field are the scenes where New England men were formed. In all countries, in all companies, for several years, I have, in conversation and in writing, enumerated the towns, militia, schools, and churches as the four causes of the growth and defense of New England. The virtues and talents of the people are there formed, their temperance, patience, fortitude, prudence, and justice, as well as their sagacity, knowledge, judgment, taste, skill, ingenuity, dexterity, and industry. Thus the slothful yeoman. It was an act of piety for Adams to locate his deepest values in the town and its related institutions. Those who know his political theory, and especially his tendency to use history as moral philosophy in such works as Dissertation on the Canon and the Feudal Law, will sense that it was not consistent of him to bow to the prescriptive past. He left family out of the picture in these remarks that I've just given you. It was perhaps too basic for an 18th century man rooted in the English village to notice. In fact, Adams sometimes warned against the danger, to republics at least, of excessive family pride, a condition he found worsened by popularity. And he also left out the institution of the law. Adams was of the first generation of Americans to find law respectable. Its power as a traditional institution was clear to John Dickinson and the 250-odd others, mostly Southerners, who had studied at the Inns of Court and knew the beauties of the common law. But to New Englanders who clung to their old yeoman hostility to the bench and the bar, it couldn't yet be considered part of the patrimony. He could not name family in law, but they stood in the town with the other institutions. When Adams exclaimed in 1776, "I dread the spirit of innovation," he was speaking from the New England town. He never changed in this respect, nor did the town for more than a century. Page Smith, who was Adams's biographer, noticed this, and a decade ago wrote, "As a City Upon a Hill, The Town in American History," a book that's had much influence on the way we look at our early heritage, at least on the way I look at it. Its message is simple. Smith says, "If we accept the family and the church, the basic form of social organization experienced by the vast majority of Americans up to the early decades of the 20th century was the small town." He found, and not always happily to him, I might add, that the town resisted innovation because its families, its churches, its town offices, economic patterns, law, social structure were all too human, too rooted in the realities of life and nature, and too rooted in the American past to yield very readily to even the powerful 19th century forces of change. It's fascinating to me that the towns described by John Adams differ in no important ways from the country villages of the McGuffey readers, the central Michigan country towns described by Curtis Stettfeld in a beautiful little book recently published, From the Land and Back, from the Murfreesboro, Tennessee, described in Andrew Nelson Lytle's Awake for the Living, or from my hometown in the late 1940s. But I don't want to get too far ahead of the story. In the years when the age of egalitarianism was dawning, when the Republic of the Founders was giving way to the various abstractions of democracy and morality, also rooted, I recognize, largely in New England, the Frenchman de Tocqueville found the town still vital and particularly important to the American form of democracy, explaining that, in his words, "The great political principles which now rule American society were born and grew up in the state." He then goes on and finds the town in the north and the county in the south antecedent to the state. Indeed, "The township is the only association so well rooted in nature that wherever man assembles, it forms itself." Reminiscent of G.K. Chesterton's later insight, "We make our friends, we make our enemies, but God makes our next door neighbor." Tocqueville said that although men make kingdoms and republics, townships seem to spring directly from the hand of God. Furthermore, and this is the important point here, the strength of free peoples resides in the local community. The strength of free peoples resides in the local community. And the local institutions of New England form a complete and regular whole. They are ancient. Law, and even more, mores make them strong, and they exercise immense influence over the whole of society. In the North, in his words, political life was born in the very heart of the townships. He sums up this way: "The New Englander is attached to his township because it is strong and independent. He has an interest in it because he shares in its management. He loves it because he has no reason to complain of his lot. He invests his ambition and his future in it. In the restricted sphere within his scope, he learns to rule society. He gets to know those formalities without which freedom can advance only through revolutions. And becoming imbued with their spirit, develops a taste for order, understands the harmony of powers, and in the end accumulates clear, practical ideas about the nature of his duties and the extent of his rights." Now, Tocqueville wasn't writing history in democracy in America, and so neglected to explain the prescriptive power of the English village and post 1660 colonial history in forming these harmonious parochial free societies in the towns. Nor did he more than note the many strange-sounding town offices, most of which still existed in 1835 when he was writing. In the New England villages, there were tithing men, hog reeves, fence viewers, sealers of casks, measures of boards and shingles, and a dozen other offices. Tocqueville thought they were administrators, merely. Lord Bryce would later explain them, however, by showing the relationship between the American town and the English parish. These functionaries were less holdovers from meddlesome Puritan days than expressions of the medieval communal sources of much of early American town life. Tocqueville did, however, see two elements of town society that are crucial to what I want to argue here. It is not incomprehensible to Tocqueville, as it is to so many contemporary historians, that the town should contain great measures of both individual freedom and communal order. And when he said, "In all that concerns themselves alone, the townships remain independent bodies," he knew that this was as true of towns in the old Northwest as in New England. It's perhaps, in his reference to towns as independent bodies, it's perhaps instructive here to note another of John Adams's many observations about the towns. He's quoting here a certain British officer, as he remembers him, in 1774, who was, as Adams says, was often heard to say, "I wish I were Parliament. I would not send a ship or troop to this country, but would forthwith pass a statute declaring every town in North America a free, sovereign, independent commonwealth. This is what they all desire, and I would indulge them. I would soon have the pleasure to see them all at war with one another from one end of the continent to the other." Well, Adams ridicules this argument, stating that the American people have much more sense than to divide in this manner. I'll leave that to Professor Bradford's comment. At any rate, Tocqueville understood that wherever towns existed, in New England, or in Western New York, or in the came to make up the five states of the old Northwest, that westward expansion, that the frontier actually intensified the loyalty of the people of the town and its institutions. Now, it is, of course, an important part of Frederick Jackson Turner's environmental, behavioral, so-called frontier thesis, that the frontier experience in American history significantly modified all westward moving institutions. Now, this would include towns, churches, schools, family, militia, law, all the traditional elements of Adams's New England towns. Turner and most other historians of the westward movement argued that the frontier spirit was innovative, was open, was egalitarian, that the Eastern institutions and European institutions before them became uniquely American only after having been stripped of civilized baggage by frontier privations. I would argue that even on the frontier, the town and its institutions remained basically conservative in spirit, that they resisted innovation and retained almost passionately the values and institutions they brought from New England. They were modified by the frontier. Michigan towns rarely retained hog reeves. And more important, the law and the family, I think, gained in importance as regulators, intimate regulators of daily life, that is. But what I find striking is the continuity, the prescriptive character of the towns, not innovation, whether on the frontier or anywhere else. In other words, another way to say this is it seems to me that the basic human values resisted the environment much more than they adapted to it. Now, let me get a little bit specific about this. The land ordinances of 1785, 1787, and 1800 shaped the Northwest Territory into rural communities of small farms, towns, schools, specifically in the acts void of slaves, and provided that the settlements should become states just like the old ones. The laws were too late for Western New York, which was Iroquois country up until 1783, and so it's more Midwest than East in background. New York, Western New York, had already fallen to the great proprietors and land companies, primarily from England and Holland. But whether settled by the Holland Land Company, by independent speculators, by federal land offices, or whether the land was given to veterans of the Revolution, the lands west of the Hudson River unanimously received the stamp of the New England town. the early settlers of Phelps, New York, home of the brave, my father used to say, where I was born, came from Vermont and Connecticut. The early settlers of Hillsdale, where I now live, came from the region around Phelps. The English and the Roman, I might add, place names that New Englanders used in western New York are duplicated in hundreds of Ohio, Indiana, southern Michigan, and Illinois towns. Now, although the frontier did not strip away town institutions or even modify them very much, the great historian and literary critic Perry Miller reminds us of a problem the frontier did bring up. The central action of James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers, published in 1823, brings the old scout Natty Bumppo, who later got younger progressively in four novels as The Deerslayer, Hawkeye, Leatherstocking, and The Pathfinder, brought Natty into conflict with Judge Marmaduke Temple, who was a very thinly disguised version of Cooper's own father, the squire of Cooperstown. Temple imposes game laws and orders the arrest of Natty, who had never killed except for food, when the old man of nature kills a deer out of season and then resists a constable who has a search warrant. Temple is trying to tame a wilderness, and so in his charge to the jury, he says, "Living as we do, gentlemen, on the skirts of society, it becomes doubly necessary to protect the ministers of the law." Natty, the natural man, wants no part of civilized rules. "Talk to me not of law, Marmaduke Temple. Did the beast of the forest mind your laws when it was thirsty and hungering for the blood of your own child?" Natty had saved Temple's daughter from the attack of a painter, as they called it, that very morning. But to the judge, that was precisely the point. The law, or we might say, the towns, the churches, the schools, the families, the law was doubly important when the beast that is man is so close at hand, as it was on the frontier. The American public in the age of Jackson may have preferred Natty Bumppo. That's hard to tell. Cooper himself could never make up his mind. Perry Miller calls Cooper's ambivalence a classic case of the 19th century dilemma, the head, in this case the law, reason, versus the heart, nature. But for our purposes, it might better be called the individual in nature versus the harmony of the traditional natural community. Despite Cooper's confusion and its updated versions in many books about that era, like Marvin Meyer's The Jacksonian Persuasion, people in the towns were relatively untroubled. They kept the balance between liberty and order that had characterized the towns historically, although they went about it in ways that suited their circumstances, sometimes slightly different from the New England ways. My research, proceeding slowly for the past 5 years on law and lawyers and the social order in western New York and these other regions, I've been poking around the basements and vaults of county courthouses, and it's slow work, is perhaps instructive on some of these points. This is tentative, but I believe that law, especially civil law, and lawyers took a rather larger part in keeping off the beast of disorder in the West than in New England. This is reasonable, since in the West, congregations were weaker and more diverse, the population was less homogeneous, and the communities were physically newer. Now, law has been used for everything in our history, including as a depository for transcendental and immutable truths. But in the towns, it was common law and common sense. It was custom, it was prescriptive habit. Townsmen came to the bench and the bar. They weren't called. It was less formal than city law or English law, and so there was less hostility to it, Natty Bumppo and his like notwithstanding. It sanctioned community behavior, it registered custom, and it also gave solid opportunity to young men seeking success, like Stephen A. Douglas, for example, who was educated in the Canandaigua Academy in western New York, read law in the office of one of the local lawyers, and then went out to seek his fortune in the Illinois towns that were so similar. It's a common story. Douglas's story is a common story in that era. Now, the common law, rightly understood, reflected, at least in the eyes of Americans, reflected through experience the Anglo-American world's understanding of God's and nature's law, the most important element of which in the country towns was protecting the balance between the rights of the rights and opportunities of the individual and the needs of the harmonious community. Law in the towns did have a redemptive character, usually combined with great entertainment value. docket books of judges and justices of the peace, which was an English office. I'm sure most of you are aware it was an ancient English county office that was universal in America. These docket books are filled with morality plays, solved usually without recourse to severe punishment. But they were always public, which meant that when the family or good order were disrupted, the entire community turned out for the show. Civil cases dominated the agenda. Civil cases, even for what we would now consider violent crimes, such as assault, rape, usually they were adjudicated in civil procedure, not criminal cases. They dominated the agendas, partly because of the structure of the court system, partly because in civil cases, the offended parties could confront each other directly in the local public arena. James Kent, later the Chancellor of New York, could solve all the criminal cases in Cayuga County, New York, by two very short visits in over a three-year period for courts of Oyer and Terminer. In the same period, there were over 300 civil cases heard in the County Court of Common Pleas. The common punishments were fines, whippings, and work sentences. Jail sentences were very rare. Jails, you know, would be an egalitarian, humanitarian reform. It was a good thing that jail sentences were rare, at least for the offenders. The jail at Aurora, New York, sat on a bluff overlooking Cayuga Lake. Prisoners got into their dirt cells by being lowered, descending a ladder through the floor and into the bluff. Cases involved every kind of behavior. Probably recovery of debt was the largest single category, but I found any number of interesting ones. One of my favorites is one in Canandaigua that reads on the cover of the summary, Abigail Smith and Thomas Brown versus George Smith and Hannah Brown for sodomy. The plaintiffs won, but neither the manner of proof nor the punishment was recorded. A farmer in Auburn sued a young man for, in his terms, debauching my daughter. He won, and the young man was assigned to 6 months of labor on the farmer's land, showing, shall we say, the limits of individual rights in a country town. When the Indian Seneca John shot a neighbor in 1804, the entire Auburn community turned out to see Elijah Miller, who would be William Henry Seward's father-in-law later, to see Elijah Miller become the first lawyer in New York State to defend an Indian for killing a white man. Justice was swift in those times, if no surer than today's. Miller had one day to prepare his defense in this case, and a change of venue was out of the question. Seneca John was hanged, despite extenuation that would today be recognized as valid. Hanged not merely because he was an Indian, but because according to the terms of the common law, rigorously applied in a congenial setting, he was guilty. Miller's 20,000-word appeal that argued for mercy failed to sway the governor. Miller argued, and the case hinged upon, the question of whether the defense of Seneca John's home was a valid reason for his pulling the trigger. The judge replied to this argument, to the delight of a crowded courthouse, that a savage in the forest has no castle. Now, despite the Roy Bean image of frontier justice, I found the quality of town legal practice to be quite high. Seth Phelps's 35 rules of practice in Cayuga County in 1799 and Elijah Miller's 26 rules of 1817 brought the community, in their own terms at least, to what they considered English levels. Now, that was probably an exaggeration. But at the very least, I think we can say that the apprentice system trained good lawyers. Daniel Shepard of Aurora, a little village of less than 300 settlers, who was a Yale graduate, had come originally to the area to wheel and deal in land, as indeed many of the lawyers first came to Western New York. That's the reason they mostly came. He found that instead he preferred the training of young lawyers. His graduates, who included over 20 county judges, 6 members of the New York State Supreme Court, 1 justice of the United States Supreme Court, and 1 governor each of New York, Michigan, and Indiana, compare favorably with the more famous office schools of people like George Wythe in Virginia, Tapping Reeves in Connecticut, and Peter Van Schaack of Kinderhook, New York. As a matter of fact, I'd say his graduates those that I mentioned were accomplished in less than a 20-year period. They probably rank with most of the American law schools in any 20-year period of the 20th century. Lawyers were also local politicians. They were real estate agents. They were accountants. And in Daniel Boorstin's term, they were boosters. But it must be pointed out that they attended to the good order of the community by establishing schools and churches even before they embarked on their more mundane and lucrative activities. One important aspect of the law's physical presence symbolizes and sums up much of what I've been trying to say: the county courthouse. Happily, a large photographic essay on these buildings, commissioned by the Bicentennial Commission in one of its saner moments, will soon appear in print. These always imposing structures reflect the citizens' concern for security and order of their new but very old communities. They were always established within a decade or so of settlement. In Auburn, citizens raised over 10,000 scarce dollars to build a fine granite structure in 1810. In Batavia, a little further west, a committee of the whole squeezed nearly twice that sum out of the community by 1817, and literally everyone in the community met to consider the construction. I find the Roman style of so many of these buildings in this area significant. They were truly, as one historian has called them, temples of democracy. Now, the law, of course, tells only part of the story of the powerful place of the town in American history. And it's encouraging that at least some of the often misdirected social history of recent years is concentrating on the family and other traditional local institutions at the town level. Too much of our heritage has been described from a national point of view, a point well made by two widely ignored recent studies, Roland Berthoff's An Unsettled People and David J. Russo's Families and Communities, two studies I commend to you highly. But if Adams was right, and Tocqueville, and if I'm right, it would do well to attend to the country towns and the virtue and order their institutions provided. We have a good deal of recapturing of our past to do. This is one more good place to start. Thank you.